The title of this talk is Life After the Mission, Keys to Success After Graduation. Now, I talked about the fact that through IUGM we're doing a research in terms of finding success at missions and a success rate. We've always believed that we're more successful than people, the worldly and non-Christian programs, and we're going to be doing some things as time goes on to actually help us prove in a real way with some data that we are better than the non-Christian programs. But right now we don't have that. It's just anecdotal. But let me tell you this. You only know that you've succeeded with an individual after they leave your facility. You believe that? I mean, you get little glimpses of progress. It's kind of like the parent, you know whether you raised your kids right by how they live once they grow up. In the same sense, you know whether you've invested what's necessary in people's lives if they succeed once they leave your care or your program or your structured environment. And so we feel that if we're going to be evaluating success at missions, then the people we need to look at is graduates and what became of them once they finished. But I know one thing, and that's for certain. We need to be doing from almost day one preparing people to leave and to live on their own. Because the goal of this whole exercise is not to make them live at the mission forever. The goal is to help them live independent lives. And so in my 9 years of cruising around missions and visiting with mission staff people through the IUGM, I think I've come up with a few things that I know if these ingredients are in place, people will have a better likelihood to succeed. And if these things are not in place, I'm almost convinced they won't. So I believe that of all the things I'll be sharing while we're here, this is probably the most powerful part of it. As I mentioned before, through IUGM, we have had task force meetings and such to take a look at success factors. What are areas of people's lives that we pretty much can say, if they do this, they're okay. They're going to be all right. They're going to grow. They're going to be productive. They're going to be sober, healthy, Christian people. And so some of the things that So we all narrowed this down to 7 success factors. We'll be talking about all this a little bit more in depth tomorrow morning, but I just wanted to share these with you for now so you can see that a person is a success, and I think you could agree with me, if they leave our program and they become gainfully employed or continue their education. Wouldn't that be success in your mind? They are successful if they're free of their primary life-controlling problems when they leave us. Their success if they have secured stabilized housing. That's a big thing. They were once homeless, now they are no longer. That they're maintaining healthy relationships. That they're achieving financial stability. That they've become content with the quality of their own lives. That they've become involved in a local church. Put all of these 7 factors together, and I think you'll have a successful program graduate. But one of the things that we need to remember is that these things don't happen by accident, right? They don't happen by osmosis. So that in your programming, in your development of curriculum, in your instruction and your counseling, in the activities in which you involve people, we need to be including something about each of these areas. We are really blessed recently through a grant from the National Endowment for Financial Education. They have devoted curriculum specialists with us that have worked with my department to create a financial education curriculum for homeless people or formerly homeless people. And in the next year or so, you'll be getting some of that information from us. And there are other issues And so I'm not going to get too specific about these factors, only to mention them to you and to get you thinking about what can we do at our program to address these issues and to help people gain those resources and knowledge that they need to achieve these areas. Now, here's what I believe are the keys to success afterwards. Number one, restoring broken relationships. There's a real excellent video series that a lot of rescue missions use called Dean Sherman's Relationship Video. It's available from Youth of the Mission. And one of the statements he makes in this series that is so vital, and he says that the quality of your life is dependent upon the quality of the relationships you have. The quality of your life is completely dependent on the quality of the relationships that you have. So unless we do something to help people restore broken relationships, if we send them out with a lot of broken relationships still intact or unintact, we're setting them up for failure. And but on the other hand, being in a rescue mission program is probably, and might be, the last opportunity they'll have in their lives to mend these broken relationships. Overcoming codependency, and this is kind of related, isn't it? Now, let me tell you this. In my experience in addiction recovery of over 20 years, I'm 100% convinced that 100% of all addicts are 100% codependent. And that even though you've removed substances from their lives, it's the only way then that you can get them to work on their codependency.
How do you define codependency?
It's coming. This is only my introduction. I'll get into the real stuff later. And then finally, the other key is connecting with two essential communities. And I'll talk about those communities in a second. Now, as you know, we talked earlier about step 4 and 5 as a way to help people experience the power of God's forgiveness in their lives, to be removed, get that toxic shame out of their lives. Well, I think in this whole area of restoring broken relationships, step 8 and step 9 of the 12-step program are really the tools that we use to restore broken relationships. Step 8 says, I made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except to do so would injure them or others. How many of you currently are bringing every person in your program through steps 8 and 9? Very few. You see, then one time I was visiting a mission and a counselor said, this man has been with us 5 times. He does wonderfully every time he's with us. But it seems like he always goes out and blows it. And 5 times. And would you please talk to him and find out what's wrong and what we need to do? And so I sat down with the guy and I said, when you leave here, do you get involved with women that aren't good for you? Yes, all the time. And what that tells me, and then my next question was, have you ever done an 8th and 9th step? No. And the reason is this. Many people who have a series of failed relationships in their lives become convinced that they can't have good relationships. That they're incapable of having good relationships, that they don't know how to have relationships, and that they never will deserve them. So if we don't help them to do something in this relationship area, they're doomed, like this man was, to repeat the same sick relationships. Because what happens is nobody can live as an island. We're always going to fall into fellowship with somebody. And if I'm convinced that the only relationships I'm deserving of or can have are sick ones, then that's what I'll end up with. And a part of the codependency of the addicts that are in our program is they'll latch on to somebody of the opposite sex right now, and they'll always be someone that's bad for them. You know, I would say probably if you look at your history of people that have relapsed after leaving your program, this is bad relationship is probably at the root of the majority of those relapses, and probably getting affiliated with someone of the opposite sex who's really sick. And even though it might not look like that at first, it's sometimes really worth it for you to ask about it. So how do you do 8 and 9? Basically, the endeavor is, the goal of this whole thing, is to help them to go to those that they've harmed with a sincere attempt to restore these relationships by making amends. And this, let me tell you, is one of the hardest things in the world. And that's why you need to be sure that they do a fourth and fifth step to get rid of all their own shame and guilt about this stuff first. We find in the Serenity New Testament a pretty neat definition of amends. Sincere efforts to offer apology for past harm. Not to minimize, not to compensate, not to blame shift, but to apologize, to acknowledge the hurt. And what are the benefits? We talked about the three basic connections that people have to make in their lives to get better. We talked about reconnecting with God and with self through gaining self-awareness, and all of this is intended for this. But this is the big one. Reconnecting with the human race, as I like to call it. You know, if disaffiliation is the root cause of all homelessness, then gaining people support and healthy relationships is probably the one big thing that's going to keep me from ever becoming homeless again. And people who get stuck in a pattern and cycle of homelessness have never been able to build the bridge back to the human race. And that's what we want to do here. And again, if I can't clean up the mess of the past related to these broken relationships, I will never have confidence to move into the future relationships that are out there for me. I'll be completely stripped of my ability to confidently establish new healthy relationships. Because I am still filled with guilt and shame and remorse of the bad history I had before. And I said before, it's one thing to, again, to do the fourth and fifth step thing, but this is another doing thing, you know. We talked about before that we don't just want to teach people stuff, we want to give them opportunities to do stuff. And to be a doer of the word, not merely a hearer. Well, making amends is one massive doing that can be a healing experience for them, regardless of how anybody responds to it. Because having a whole basketful of broken, unattended relationships is something people will carry with them. Because when you hit the pillow your head hits the pillow at night, who you're going to think about is who you hurt, those relationships that have been damaged. You carry that with you. So what's an amends? It could be a verbal apology. It's a recognition of the hurt and wrong inflicted. Rather than saying, that wasn't that big a deal, which is minimizing, it wasn't my fault, which is blame shifting. Yes, I did this. I acknowledge that I caused you harm. And it could also mean restitution, which could be repayment of money or some other gesture intended to restore losses from individuals that were harmed. Now, I have a story of restitution in my life that was really amazing. Well, I was a druggie in high school, and I got a janitor's job through the welfare program one summer. And one of my jobs one day was cleaning the principal's office. And what I discovered there was all of the hot lunch tickets for the whole year in a box. And so nobody was around. And so I carefully went through every week of the school year and took about 20 tickets. And for the next year, dealt in illegal lunch tickets to buy marijuana. I think it probably was about a 10th grader or something like that. Well, here I had gone to college. I was in seminary. And I was studying in Minneapolis at the time. And one night the Lord just laid his hand on me about all the stuff I stole from the school. I had a typewriter and some athletic equipment and all this stuff. And I'd already been out of high school several years. But I knew exactly where it was at my parents' house. And I knew how much about what those lunch tickets were worth. So one day, I did two things. One thing, I took all the athletic stuff and other typewriter and stuff and actually put them in the hallway at the school and no one was looking and then brought them back. And then I sent a check for $50 to the school saying, when I was in summer, I took all his lunch tickets and here's my money that I took. And for me, it was a tremendous release. It was wonderful. Because I knew, regardless of whatever happened, I had made these things right. Well, in response to the check I sent to the school, I got a letter from the superintendent who said to me, I've been a superintendent for 30 years and never have I ever had a student do this sort of thing. And so I'd like you to know that we have a scholarship fund for deserving students that you should apply for, which paid for my next 3 years of seminary. No, I didn't know about the payoff, right? But God, in his mind, wanted to provide for my seminary, which was thousands of dollars, by a simple act of obedience, for conscience sake, not for reward, but for me. And I think that that story I share a lot with mission guys, because we don't do it for the gain, but there's always a payoff when God is honored by our obedience. So where do you start with this? Well, you go back to step four, where you've got this written inventory of your own most troubling sins and character defects. And again, people have taken and shared these things with a trusted person that can keep them confidential, and they'll experience God's grace. We talked about burning these things, shredding them, etc. That's where you have to start. And if you look at these step four things, probably 90% of them will be things that relate to other people. You know what I'm saying? And it's going to talk about family and children and ex-spouses and siblings. That's normally what the step four stuff is all about. So right there in step four, you do have the keys to a good eighth and ninth step. So how does it work? Well, who do you make amends to? And I think the easiest way for you to tell somebody this is to think about all the people that have been harmed by your addiction. Make a list of them. And that includes our kids and others, and usually our family of origin. That's normally where it's the people closest to us probably that we've inflicted the greatest harm to. That's usually where we start. And you start with the closest ones to you. Like those who are still living, for instance, are easier to make amends to those who have died than those who have died. Those who live in the same city than where you live are closer than those who might be far away. Those who are spouses, ex-spouses, friends, family members are easier to track down than maybe other friends. And there are some cautions there. One might be that there are only those to whom partial disclosure can be made, because to do so would do more harm than good. You know, for instance, if that takes a lot of discernment, but say you had an affair with the spouse of a friend, you may need to be careful about how that's done. You may need to feel it out. You may not be ready for that. There may be things that other people were involved with you, that talking about your, so you can't make your amends in a way that would harm them, because they may not be ready to make amends like you. So there's a whole bunch of issues like that. There are some amends that really should be deferred until a later date. Often it could be because the hurts are way too fresh. And to go to somebody with them, you can't expect a good outcome because they're still too fresh. And sometimes also, we might have resentments in ourselves that aren't settled yet. And I think one thing you'll find if you begin working with people and coaching them in this 8th and 9th step process is that counseling issues might arise where they know that they harm somebody, but they may still have a lot of resentment and bad feelings toward them. They might have a whole lot of family origin issues, and some of this stuff may have to be taken care of before they have confidence to go out and do this part. And the truth is, there may be some people that it's better never to contact, because it could just open the door up to some sick relationship again. For instance, past sexual partners, some of that sort of thing. And that's why I think, honestly, that our role as rescue mission counselors is to do coaching and rehearsing of these things. Rather than just saying, okay, here's your list, go for it, guy. To sit down and say, let's take some time and talk about how we're going to do this. And maybe practice on me. Tell me what you will plan to tell them. And I'll give you feedback to tell you if the way you're doing it really makes sense. Because sometimes what can happen when newly recovering people try to make amends is that they have a tendency to blame shift. You know, I know you treated me rotten, so I'm sorry for being so mean to you too, you know? That's probably not a good amends. Because the focus has to be not on anything they did, but owning my own stuff. And when you're a codependent person and have been in denial for a long time, blame shifting is really a big deal. And that's why this coaching rehearsing thing can be so important. Also, you know, it may be that it helps them to know whether or not it's even a situation to make amends, because some people have false guilt. Some people are guilty about situations really that they might have been standing up for themselves. You know what I'm saying? So hopefully we'll be a good mirror and a good feedback person so that they can decide, help them to say, well, this is a real amends or this may not be a real amends. And also, through coaching, I think one of the big messages we want to make sure they get is that if I make amends, it has nothing to do with ignoring, excusing, condoning any abuse or wrong that someone may have done to us. And we see this oftentimes that people have had abusive parents, for instance. And so if they have, or an abusive ex-spouse, for instance. And so even though they may have a need to make amends for their part, because we're making amends doesn't say everything you did to me was okay. You know what I'm saying? We're not minimizing the way they treated us, but we're trying to get a hold of our own stuff and our own attitudes, and we're trying to get a hold of our own things that we need to do to make it right. Because really, we don't want to make amends for them. We make amends for us and our relationship with God. So here's a real practical suggestion. The main point is we are responsible for the hurtful things we have done in respect to these relationships. You know, and a lot of times, sometimes when relationships are mucky and codependent and dysfunctional, A good thing to do is to take a sheet of paper, draw a line down the middle, my stuff, their stuff. You know, make columns that way. This is my stuff, this is their stuff. You know, to help focus on what's my part. Because I certainly can't get free. I don't find freedom in my conscience by confessing someone else's sin. Just my own. And we need to prepare people for the risk of rejection. I think this is one of the hardest things to deal with in making amends. Because we've gone through this spiritual struggle to do this. We've gone through all the pain and remorse and work to do it right. And yet there's no guarantee that they, you know, will receive it. I mean, they could say how sorry and remorseful and sad they are about what happened, and a person could turn around and say, well, I always thought you were a rotten thief, and now I know for sure, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean it wasn't worth doing? No. Because I don't do it. For how they react has nothing to do with the value of my amends. It's like Jesus said, right? If you are at the altar and you know someone has ought against you, go make it right with them first and then come back and present your sacrifice. So this is a very scriptural context. And that's why in the recovery movement and in the 12 steps, the power that's in them is not the steps themselves, but the power they derive from God's truth that they contain. And that's why this is a powerful spiritual principle. So we need to prepare people for this risk of rejection. You might reveal something to them that makes them so angry they never want to see you again. But that's not why you did it. It's for your own conscience. It has nothing to do with changing their attitude towards you. But what happens when I've done these things to make it right with these other relationships in my life, I don't have all this baggage back here that's going to hold me back from moving into healthy relationships. I'm not going to feel all guilty and ashamed of the way I've treated people in the past because I've started a new way of living. I've started to do things differently in my life. It's like a good 8 to 9 step exercise is like closing the door to this part of my life and moving into a whole new realm. So let's talk about codependency again. And these are gigantic subjects, and I'm going through them pretty fast. And I'm only giving this to you as maybe ways for you to think about this, maybe also incentive to learn more about this. But I'm telling you that in a women's shelter, the experience I've had, practically 100% of the women that are there because they're codependent. Whether it's been their addiction or someone else's, their dysfunction or the family of origin, they're codependent. And until they can work through this, there's no hope for real dynamic change in their lives. The same thing with the alcoholics and drug addicts. Unless they get a handle on this and begin to move forward with growth in this area, you're going to repeat the same old stuff again. And let me tell you, frustration in relationships is a big reason people get so stressed out and relapse. Because codependency doesn't just mean doing bad stuff, but it's not knowing how to get the good stuff either. So here's a couple of definitions of codependency. See if they work for you. Codependency is defining ourselves by how we think others see us. So it's like I don't have enough awareness of who I am to tell you who I am. But who I am is based 100% upon how others see me. There's a big difference there. Using other people to create good feelings within ourselves. That my happiness depends upon how you react to me. That I don't know how to be at peace unless I know you have good thoughts about me. And another classic one is, which is probably more accurate in some ways, seeking affirmation, acceptance, and fulfillment of deep inner needs from others that can only be met by God Himself and a healthy sense of self. I have a typo there. Seeking affirmation, acceptance, and fulfillment of deep inner needs from other people that can only be met by God Himself and a healthy sense of who I am. Does that make sense? In other words, what makes me okay is not contained within me. But I need stuff out here to help me to know I'm okay. But if I don't have it inside of me, I'll always be a person who's unfulfilled, unhappy, ungrateful, unloving, uncontent, or discontent. So how do you know if somebody's got this? And I talked about toxic shame, an inner self, a sense of self-rejection. And people are always putting themselves down. If people don't seem to be appreciating, able to take compliments, if people are not experiencing the joy of and peace in their lives, it's usually because there's that inner sense of self-rejection. A couple of the things we talked about, the steps, the fourth and fifth, eighth and ninth, that can really make a difference. Being with positive, affirming people makes a difference. Celebrating my progress makes a difference. All of these things that we do in the healing environment make a difference. Another thing that people codependent have is a sense of little or no control over the circumstances of their lives. It's that bad stuff always happens to me. That somehow my own destiny is really not in my hands. That I'm going to be forever a victim. A passivity in the face of disturbing and dangerous situations. Have you seen people like that? You know what they're doing is going to result in chaos and hurt and destructive stuff, and yet somehow they seem completely powerless to stop the route they're going, or don't recognize or don't see what's coming down the road. Another thing is an avoidance of social support. They don't want other people to know their needs. They don't trust other people. They don't include them in their lives. They don't share their joys. They don't share their struggles. They keep their distance. They don't let other people in. Another symptom is guessing at what is normal. Now, whether you're a spouse of an alcoholic, a parent of an alcoholic, or person who grew up in a dysfunctional family, because you haven't had models of healthy behavior, you're going to spend your life guessing at what's normal and hoping that you get it right. Mm-hmm. And finally, out of touch with your emotions. Some people oftentimes call it living life from the head up, from the neck up. That you're out of touch with your heart, what's going on inside of you, all the feelings and emotions that make life worth living. It becomes really a very frustrating way to live. And let me tell you that when it comes to codependency, I wish I could give you a simple, do this and all of a sudden it gets better. But codependency is a lifelong, because it's something that has happened to you over a lifetime, it's probably going to be something you will deal with for a lifetime. And so the more you can learn about it through reading good books, participating in adult children and alcoholic support groups, maybe getting professional counseling, learning how to identify safe people, having positive relationships in your life, growing spiritually, finding a good church home, these are all dynamics that will help people to overcome this codependency. And I only brought this up by way of saying, in your programming, in your curriculums, make sure that this whole area is addressed. And there's a lot of good resources out there. One of the best books that you could ever read is Melody Beattie's book called Codependent No More. That's a classic in that area and very helpful. Now, and finally, let me talk about the two communities. I believe that we need to make sure that if we've started a healing community experience in the program, we want to make sure that some of the dynamics of the good stuff that has been going on while they're with us will continue when they're gone. And so that the only way that's going to happen is if we can help them identify healing communities out there and helping them to participate in healing communities in the community outside of the mission. And this is where Morris Vandenberg's vision. Morris Vandenberg is the past director of City Union Mission, served here for 37 years, and came up with one of the first long-term men's programs ever, back in the 50s and 60s. And here, this was his vision. Our goal is to see that every program graduate becomes a mature, contributing member of a Christian community. So the first community we want people to become involved with is the body of Christ. Now, let me tell you what I oftentimes see is the only contact program people have with the body of Christ. Sunday morning, they all pile into the mission van and go to First Community Church. They all pile off, shake hands with the greeter, sit in the back row, hear the sermon, jump back on the mission van, and go back to the mission. Okay. Then, they're getting ready to graduate, and we tell them, okay, you've got to join a church now. It doesn't work that way. And I am here to challenge you to be more creative in how you do this. The other community is the recovery community. So the spiritual community, who identify the spiritual community in your community, identify the recovery community in your community, and think about how you can get graduates into these communities while they're in your building so that they'll have relationships already in place that they can then have when they leave. You see, too often times we send them out into a vacuum and hope that they're going to get this figured out on their own, which is wrong. So let's talk about connecting with the church. In your community are what I would call mission-friendly churches. Now, they may not be the ones that give you the most money, although some of them may be. But I think that you need to spend some time looking at your volunteer base, looking at your contribution base, looking at who's there, and find out the churches that really, really, really care for what you're doing, who really are your partners in ministry. Because, and I say, those are the folks that you want to try to filter your program graduates to. People who have a heart for what you're doing, people who will receive these guys and girls with open arms. So when you know who these folks are, make sure that you set up an appointment to meet with these pastors. And what you may want to do is visit them and say, we really want to work on getting our guys involved with churches when they leave. And we need your help. You might develop a pastor's orientation luncheon. When I was in the program in Michigan, I was an officer in our local clergy council. And so what I did for one of our monthly meetings is I invited the clergy council to meet at our mission and have lunch served by the people in our program. That was a really excellent thing because, first off, it was the first time that most of them had ever set foot in our building. But boy, it really gave them an opportunity then to see who we are, what we're doing. And many of them got more committed to what we were doing because they set foot in our building. And you may have a orientation type of a meeting for them if they are interested in partnering more with you. And also, what you might ask these pastors is if they have any families in their congregation that you think might be open to sponsoring folks from the mission who graduate to help them become part of the church family. It might have them over dinner once in a while, but would sit by them in church. That may pick them up, give them a ride. And there's, I think, ways you can actually have training sessions then for these people. And let me say finally that my opinion of all the resources out there in the body of Christ, Christian support groups like Overcomers Outreach or Alcoholics Victorious, Alcoholics for Christ, are probably the bridge, the most powerful bridge between the mission and the body of Christ. I have a little diagram here. And I see that the Christian support group is kind of right here, the place where the recovery community and the spiritual community comes together. And so it's absolutely important that you begin to find out about the Christian support groups in your community. Because the Christians who are recovering themselves probably can identify more with your graduates than anybody. And if you don't have Christian support groups in your community, I mean, you might, you know, check with large churches in your area, check with, you know, drug helplines and find out. But if you don't, maybe you would have an opportunity to minister to the church by starting one yourselves. And the added benefit of that is that then you would have something for your graduates to keep a lot of the good stuff they started while they were with you going. And so, for instance, we have, you know, IEGM has the Alcoholics Victorious 12-Step Fellowship. We have, right now, about 150 groups. But what's really kind of shocking or sad in some ways is that we have more of them in Salvation Armies than we do in IEGM missions right now. But these people who are in recovery can become sponsors and can become advocates and mentors to our people who are recovering, and it can be very, very effective. So I would encourage you not to send program people or graduates to any church that you or another staff person hasn't visited personally. You know, research your community, find the healthy, mission-friendly churches. You know, if you have people in your program, that's where you want them to send to go while they're with you, and hopefully we'll continue those relationships when they're leaving you. In the same sense, I wouldn't send anybody, whether in my program or a graduate, to the support group that I haven't visited myself. And, you know, support groups are a lot like churches. They have different leadership, different personalities. There are some support groups, even Christian ones, that I wouldn't send people to. It's like there are some churches I wouldn't want people to go to. You need to be discerning, and the only way you can know about it is to visit, and maybe more than once. So I thought maybe we'd just wrap this up by giving you what I feel are the hallmarks of the healthy support group. One of the big things that we look for is confidentiality, and that's basically that what you stay here, who you see here stays here. Another one is avoid crosstalk, interrupting out of turn, offering unsolicited advice and counseling during the meeting. A support group is different than a therapy group or a class. It's really intended to be a chance where each person has a chance in turn to share. Another thing is that you have, with a support group, you have a combination of personal support along with group accountability. And that's why we want people involved with support groups, secular support groups like AA or Al-Anon, as well as especially the Christian support groups, because not only can they go there and remember not to drink every week, but also they know that there are people that are expecting things of them, expecting growth, and will hold them accountable. Also, it's an environment that really does encourage some honest sharing of personal experiences, thoughts, and feelings. A healthy support group is a place where I can tell people what's on my heart, share my struggles with them, help them to have a chance to experience that healing therapeutic value of talk we mentioned earlier. So that a support group really is a safe and non-judgmental environment for a risky experience of sharing and verbalizing emotions. I mentioned earlier about success, and I said basically that we have succeeded with people if they leave our program as struggling baby Christians, you know. And so that says, number one, that their struggles won't end when they leave our program. As a matter of fact, they might just begin, because they've left a nice, safe, sheltered environment and are going to be subject again to a lot of temptation and stress and pressure of life all over again. And so it's vital that they have this kind of a support group to fall back on, to find encouragement, to find relief, to find other things. And when we talk about codependency and some of these deep, deep family of origin issues and struggles that people have, you know, some of that stuff will never be even dealt with until 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years after initial sobriety. You know that? Because basically for the first 3 to 5 years, people are still remembering not to drink. They're still trying to stay away from the drug of choice. But they need to know that there's resources and know where they're found and know how to access them when these other relationship struggles and marriage struggles and other struggles happen. So we need to help them to be equipped, and sometimes the best knowledge is not how to fix things, but where to find the help. And so that, again, a healthy support group is not the entire recovery process, and don't see them as a total solution, but as part of the process. Healthy support groups communicate acceptance, freedom of expression without fear of rejection. It's an atmosphere of positive reinforcement, support, hopefulness, and in some ways becomes a family atmosphere where newcomers can fit in pretty easily. And we look for stable, mature leadership, but not groups that are controlled by one or two dominant people. It should be a group accountability. And finally, some definite format like the 12 steps for the meetings. Important. So that's, you know, and we have information here. If you don't have a local Christian support group and like to know how to develop Alcoholics Victorious, we're very happy to work with you to do that. We also have at IEGM a lot of information about support groups around the country that we've compiled. So if you want to know how to find out what's going on locally, we may have that information for you. So just to summarize this again, the three things that I believe are essential for support or success after your mission is, number one, restoring broken relationships. Number two, addressing the issue of codependency, which they're going to face as soon as they leave your building. And number three, to be plugged into these two essential communities. Any questions? Okay. Well, we'll see you tomorrow morning. I have one more session to do then. Thanks again.